Welcome to the Big Drink Rethink, the podcast for anyone questioning their relationship with alcohol or simply wondering what more life might hold. I'm Anna Donaghy, alcohol mindset coach, author and former strategist, and each episode is going to blend lived experience, psychological insight and powerful tools to help you understand your habits and gently rethink your drinking in a way that throws open oodles of possibilities. So whether you're trying to quit, cut down, or you're just plain curious, then you are in the right place. Let's rethink things together and explore what you're really thirsty for. So welcome back to the Big Drink Rethink. And today's episode is one that I've been looking forward to for a while because it starts somewhere I know we can all relate to and ends somewhere that might genuinely surprise you. We're talking holidays and we're talking broader than that. We're talking travel. Now, in my coaching work, I've noticed that holidays occupy a very particular place in people's relationship with alcohol. People will try all kinds of things, but a holiday without drinking, that's where most people draw the line. I'll start after we get back, people say to me. I hear that a lot. And I've always found, I've always found that worth examining. Most of us have grown up with a very particular kind of script for what a holiday is supposed to feel like, and alcohol is written into it almost every single scene. Now, today's guest has spent 38 years living outside of that script, and the last few years asking other people what that's been like for them too. Teresa Bergen is a travel writer based in Portland, Oregon, whose work has appeared across many online and print publications. She's also a longtime non-drinker who wanted to help others see the world without booze, and so she wrote a book about it, The Sober Travel Handbook, published in February of this year. It draws on her own experience in interviews with over 50 non-drinkers of all kinds to explore what travel looks like and what it feels like when alcohol simply isn't part of the picture. And what I love about Teresa's perspective is, of course, it's not prescriptive. She's not here to tell us whether to drink or not. You know, that's not the style on this podcast ever. She's here because travel is one of those environments where our relationship with alcohol becomes unusually visible. And that visibility, it turns out, can be really, really interesting. So without much ado, Teresa, welcome to the Big Drink Rethink.
Hey, Anna, thanks so much for having me on your show.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you for being here. I know we've got loads to talk about, and I know that you can and do talk about travel all the time, so I just really want to make sure we spend as much time there as possible. As we are recording this, it is May, and we are on the cusp of what most people would consider to be their sort of travel and holiday season, so I want us to get into that. But just before we do, can I just ask, you were relatively young when you stopped drinking. So I do want to give listeners that context. You've been a non-drinker for 38 years, but you have traveled both as a drinker and a non-drinker, right? You've seen literally the world from both sides.
Yes, I was only 20 when I quit drinking. So I wasn't even of legal age in the US where I grew up. So I had different kinds of travels then because I was a very young and broke person at the time. So not only was I drinking out of hand, but, you know, I was also running out of money. And it was a different kind of thing. There was like more hitchhiking involved and more running out of money and begging for, a few bucks to get another drink. I mean, it was a very different time for me than it is now, thank goodness. And what looks sort of fun when you're 20, it doesn't look good in your 50s. So I'm really glad I stopped when I did.
Fair point. Yeah, I have a daughter who, age 18, is about to go off traveling on that sort of shoestring.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, rather her than me. I mean, she's going to have a great time, obviously. Okay, so I wanted to start with the landscape that we're all operating in, because I think before we can talk about what it's like to step outside of the script, we ought to name what the script actually is. Now, holidays, the airport, the departure lounge, that particular sort of feeling of permission that seems to descend the moment that we get through security, the in-flight drinks, drinks on arrival, drinks by the pool, drinks that evening just, you know, to unwind, to make sure the unwinding is done. Most of us have grown up with that picture of travel, particularly holidays. I know that's a particular sort of holiday picture. And most of us have never really examined where it's come from. When you think about the cultural story we've been told about holidays and drinking, where do you think it originates? Where do you see it coming from? How did it become, how did drinking become so central to, I suppose, what switching off is supposed to look like?
I think people equate going on a holiday and drinking with carefree and blowing off steam and letting go of stress. So there's an idea that our everyday life and work is kind of drudgery and we make ourselves do it. We're like on this treadmill of working and paying the bills and stuff. And then we go on a holiday and it's fun and it's freeing and we let our hair down and we drink. I think that's kind of the idea. But that doesn't really acknowledge that there's a lot of stress in drinking, especially if you're someone who's questioning your relationship with alcohol or who already knows you drink too much. I mean, if you really can just go and have a glass of wine with dinner, or like I grew up in a family. My parents were not alcoholics. They had like one cocktail a night, a gimlet. They, you know, very 50s drink, a gimlet. And they really enjoyed it and it was never a big deal. So if you're like that, I mean, you know, whatever, more power to you. But if you're someone who's questioning your relationship and feeling like your holidays could maybe be more fun if you rethink about how much you drink, then that's a different kind of story. And also, if you just go and you drink, like I was a blackout drinker. So if you're someone who drinks like I did, I mean, what a waste of money. You spend all this money to go somewhere and just drink and forget stuff. You could have just stayed home and done that and saved a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's very true. If you're literally going to sort of pass out or blackout and miss a lot of the memories. I think, you know, you and I were talking off air when we first met and you're from Portland, Oregon. I'm based in the UK and I was describing the UK package holiday culture to you. I'm 55 years of age and I think, you know, I remember these all my life. From an early age, it was the continent at the time. We would get far further afield these days, but you know, you're going to the continent, you're going to Spain or France or Portugal if you're really exotic. And it quite literally was billed as a 2-week holiday where you're going to get to the airport, get on a plane, get to resort, and then flop by the side of the pool for 2 weeks. That was the archetypal summer holiday. And I think, you know, trends may have changed and people go to different places these days. But the principle, I think, of 2 weeks flopping down and drinking is such a strong part of the UK psyche, at least, that it's one of those really, really ingrained associations. I did a podcast last year, a bit later in the year, actually, around sort of June time, just talking about sunshine triggers and stuff like that. And holidays came up. And it's exactly as you've just said, you know, we have a sort of sacred amount of holiday, don't we? And we've just associated it with blowouts, indulgence, relaxation. And of course, that's where a strong, strong alcohol association comes from. Is it the same in the States? Is there that sort of 2-week package thing?
No, we don't really have that, but I'd say there's a big spring break culture among young people that's maybe a little more like that. Like college kids will go off and just drink like crazy for the spring break week. That's probably the closest. Where I grew up, though, since I'm American, we were very into our cars. So we went on family road trips all the time. And I grew up in San Diego, which is kind of at the far southwestern corner of the U.S. So we would just like drive up the long state of California and all stay in motels together. So fortunately, I didn't have that kind of drinky equation with my early travel. It was just like family road trips, going off seeing tourist attractions, going to a lot of nature places. Actually, it was pretty nice. It was pretty nice. So I didn't have that. But I think people do, like I said, spring break. And then I've also heard that in Canada, there's a lot of that same package holiday culture, you know, our neighbor to the north. And I think it's partly because both the UK and Canada are generally, there's a lot more kind of rainy weather. And so there's that sun kind of idea. The US, we have, you know, it's such a big country. So we have a lot of different geographical areas. So probably people in the Northeast, they might go to the Caribbean for some sun, but there's lots of places you can go within the States that are also, you know, sunny and varied. Mm-hmm. So it's a little different, but I have heard of that. I understand that landscape. Yeah.
But it's funny because actually it's very topical because this last week, one of the airline chief execs, a guy called O'Leary, who's the chief exec of Ryanair in the UK, he's actually called for a ban on the sale of alcohol in airports before 6 o'clock in the morning because of the costs that are beginning to be incurred by flights being diverted by unruly.
Oh, by the behavior of the passengers?
By the behavior.
Fascinating.
Yeah, he's literally, it's really interesting because he sort of cited it as a real cost to the airlines that people are literally boarding planes at 7 o'clock in the morning already pie-eyed because pub chains in the airports have been selling alcohol. He's asked for a ban. And I was thinking, I know he's coming at it from the commercial perspective of trying to sort of avoid these costs, but I just think it raises a bigger question about why we're going to airports and drinking at 6 o'clock in the morning at all as a cultural permission when we wouldn't do that anywhere else or on any other day of the year. It for me, that was just like, there it is. There it is. That is just an encapsulation of the culture right there.
Yeah, you have that holiday principle, but then you also have with airports, lots of times people are drinking at strange hours because they've been traveling, they're making connections, they've been up for a long time. So it doesn't really seem like it's not like they got up at 5 and decided to have a drink. They've been up maybe for 25 hours and they're like, might as well have a drink. And then there's also a lot of people have fear of flying. And so they use some alcohol to tamp down their anxieties before getting on a plane or while they're on a plane. But I got to say, I feel for those people because I was that kind of drinker. Fortunately, I didn't do that on planes, but I was a kind of drinker that got really drunk. I mean, I felt like I lived a very public life. I got sober in New Orleans, which is a 24-hour city. People are acting out all the time. So I was like living my life drunk in public, and I made so many stupid scenes in different places and got kicked out of so many places because I was doing some stupid dramatic bullshit. So my heart goes out to those people because I could so imagine me doing something stupid like that on a plane and getting in all kinds of trouble.
Have you ever been responsible for a plane being diverted to another country?
Well, probably only because I was too broke to go on a plane when I was drinking. I was more like riding the Greyhound buses around the country.
You know, in all fairness, one of the CEOs of one of the biggest pub chains in the UK did come out with the defense that you made, that many people are in connecting flight situations and, if they want to have a drink, they should be allowed to have a drink and they're on different time zones and it doesn't feel like 6 o'clock in the morning to them. But I guess it just paints the picture of, a little microcosm of society where the permission is there. But I think it's the association. So let's get back to that, because I know obviously you've worked as a travel writer for goodness, many years. You've been through all, many, many hotels, lots of different airlines, press trips, the whole industry. What do you notice about the way that the whole world is built is, this alco-centric world, this whole industry?
People expect you to drink.
Mm. As a travel writer as well,
As a person. As a human in most countries, I think, or in a lot of countries. People, that's just the norm. I'd say, I think about this sometimes. Like, if you go to a bar with some friends and you order a non-alcoholic drink, often people will say, oh, you're not drinking? Why not? But if you go to a bar and you order a drink with alcohol, does anybody ever say, why are you drinking? I mean, it's just the expectation is that the alcohol is going to be there in the drink, in the vacation, in the airport, on the airplane, at the resort, at the family gathering, at the wedding, whatever.
So, because you mentioned, I know when we were talking, you mentioned a press trip where you felt real pressure to drink, almost as if you were sort of somehow breaking the unwritten contract of the trip. Can you just share that story again? Because I thought it was so interesting.
Oh yeah, it does happen pretty often that someone will kind of pressure. They won't just ask once; they'll ask like three times for a drink. But this one I was telling you about, I was recently at a trip in Florida, and it was lunchtime, and I went out with some of the other people on the press trip, the rest of the writers and our PR handler, and I think there were five of us, and everyone else ordered some kind of an alcohol drink, and then the server came to me, and I said, kind of discreetly, because I don't like to just yell about it, whatever, I said, I'll just have a club soda, please. And she said, what? Don't you want something fun? And I was like, no. And then she says, how about a few shots of vodka in your club soda? I mean, it was just, yeah. Yeah. So for me, I mean, I've been sober a long time. I found this kind of offensive, but mostly I thought, oh, that's a really good example of the kind of thing I talk and write about. But if I was somebody who was just trying to not drink, or was kind of newly sober, or was more embarrassed by not drinking, I mean, that would be really, really uncomfortable to be kind of called out in front of my peers. Like, first, there's this assumption that if you don't drink, you're not a fun person.
Oh, yeah, that was named.
Yeah, and then that you're just different from everybody else, and what they're doing is the norm, even though it's like noon, you know, it's not even a prime drinking time.
Mm. I mean, it's rude.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously it exemplifies, it makes the point that we're making, that it's, you know, it's kind of expected in those kind of environments, as in most environments. It's a social norm, isn't it? So, you know, it feels odd when you break away from that, but there's an element of real ignorance around that as well, though. As you say, if you had been newly sober, if you were struggling, if you had a problem, if those wounds were still fresh, it's a pretty crap example of somebody not being particularly smart or clever.
Yeah, and I'm sure in her mind, I'm not saying she was a bad person. I'm sure in her mind she was being hospitable. She wanted to include me in the fun.
She was trying to facilitate fun, and she thought that.
Yeah, she just needs better training. And if I hadn't been with the press, I mean, there's a chance if I hadn't been with a press group around professional people, and I didn't want to embarrass my, you know, the PR person that was telling it, take his run, I might have said to her, you know, psst, hey, some of us are in recovery and we don't appreciate that. And I might have given her that training myself, since the people in charge of the place aren't training. Because, you know, I think you only have to tell someone that any normal person a time or two, and they're going to be like, oh my God, I didn't think about that. I'm really sorry. So, there was nothing malicious on her part, but it's just that a lot of people, they haven't been trained that way. It's weird to me, though, because I feel like almost everybody has been affected by addiction. Like, I don't know who I talk to who, even if they haven't had it themselves, they're not like, oh, my Uncle Joe had that, or my sister's been struggling with something, or I have a friend. So it seems like it should be easy to understand that if someone says no, you just need to respect that and move on. But a lot of people, they don't.
No. Maybe there will come a time, but it still sort of reinforces that whole point about, you know, the only drug we have to apologize for not taking.
Mm.
So, I mean, I named it when I did the intro to this episode. You know, so many people will say to me, I intend to stop drinking, but I'm going to get my summer holidays out of the way first. I'm going to, you know, come back to this one later in the year. And very often, I mean, there's a sort of, you can see the peaks and the troughs of podcast listenership even. You know, people don't want to listen to podcasts about not drinking during the summer so much.
Mm-hmm.
They're using them as a support, but otherwise they don't want them to be like making them feel bad about drinking if they're carrying on. And I think it's fascinating, the idea that travel isn't just a context where alcohol shows up, but it's actually a sort of a mirror in a way. It shows us things about our relationship with alcohol that everyday life tends to hide. And I'll give you an example of this. When I do start working with people, I'll say to them always, to try and sort of surface their belief around alcohol, I'll say, what are the reasons why you really, really want to give up? And they will undoubtedly list a long list of the things that they hope to get out of not drinking. And then I say, what are the biggest fears you have of giving up? And they start to surface their fears. And it strikes me that every single one of them is almost supercharged in a holiday environment. They will say, oh, I'm not going to have fun anymore. I don't know how else to relax. You know, holidays in particular are going to be really, really hard. I'm not going to be able to connect with people in the same way. I'm just not going to have the same experiences whenever I go to places. And this, in a way, is holidays, isn't it? This is the holiday experience right there. Do you see what I'm saying? You can almost ask people why they wouldn't give up in front of a holiday, and you would use it as a diagnostic tool for what their relationship with alcohol actually is. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. You know what was really funny to me recently? I don't know if I told you this when we were talking before, but I belong to a really large travel writer organization, which I'm not going to say the name just because of the story, but it's a really good organization. I get a lot out of it, but we have an annual meeting, and the meeting for this year, so it was announced last year, and it was announced that it was going to be held at a very lovely retreat center, but the retreat center, as people investigated and learned, doesn't serve alcohol. And a full year in advance, people started talking on the society Facebook group. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? And I thought, wow, they are worried a full year out about not being able to drink when they're in a professional and social situation.
For how long? For how long would they be there?
Like 3 or 4 days.
Okay.
You know, and obviously you can smuggle your own booze into a situation like that. I mean, that's what I would do. I wouldn't be talking about it on the Facebook. I would just be planning how to smuggle my booze in. But I think it is kind of diagnostic when we worry this much about something so far in ahead or just going to vacation. And I think the things that people worry about are there's the fear of missing out. There's the real sense of not belonging. Like when I interview people about not drinking, one of the main things they say is the uncomfortable feeling of being the odd person out. Like yeah. Everyone else is drinking, but they're not. So that's an uncomfortable. Also, there's so much pressure put on the holiday, especially with social media. Like, you know, you have all these 10 most Instagrammable things and you see all these people having this beautiful time, you know, and they all look great and they're having fun and they're on a beach and maybe they have a drink. And there's this expectation of this, of what this is supposed to be like. But I think people, two of the reasons they blow it if they are trying not to drink, they go on holiday and either they get caught up in the celebratory spirit and they're like, oh, I'm just going to have fun. Or they go and it's not as good as they expected and they start to feel really uncomfortable and sorry for themselves. And so then they kind of drink out of consolation or trying to tamp down the anxiety.
Mm-hmm. It's incredible. I mean, I look back at the holidays I used to go on when I was a very heavy drinker, and that they're a bit of a blur to me. And it saddens me actually to say that. I ought to add that that really does sadden me, not just because of the extortionate amount of money that I spanked away on holidays that feel like a bit of a blur, but also, you know, and I'm not going to go into this in any great depth, it's not what this is all about, but some of those holidays should be sacred family memories, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, when the kids were younger and stuff. And I treated them as just opportunities to drink without sanction, without judgment, because woohoo, we're here in wherever and the rules are different because it's on holiday and holiday rules, there are no rules. So it was complete permission to drink myself into 2-week-long haze at great cost. So when I say to people about, you know, how about going away this year and trying not to drink as much, they go, don't be so bloody ridiculous. It's a holiday. Of course I'm going to drink. And yet, you know, now both sides of the coin, as you have, you know, from both perspectives, I know that holidays are more vivid. I know they're more fun. I remember more. I remember the food, the nuance, the texture, the sounds, the smells. I remember the detail. It is so more... It's like everything's been turned up on color and sound and memories and everything, and literally everything. Conversations I have with locals, the places I go and see that I wouldn't have got off my arse and gone to see if I could have just sat by the bar. And, you know, it's ironic that we say, well, I've invested so much in this holiday. Of course I'm going to drink. It's my holiday. It's sacred time and it's my money. Of course I'm going to drink. And you just think, to dull the experience. And I'm not saying people come back saying they've had a crap holiday, but I guess it's not knowing how good it can be, isn't it? That's the problem.
Yeah. And I think a lot of, okay, so I'm, you know, I'm American, I'm white. I grew up with a lot of, I mean, I don't like to go on and on about, oh, my privileges, my privilege that, but it's a real thing. A lot of people don't have the money to travel. And a lot of countries, people don't get the visas, even if they have a good reason, their government doesn't give them the visas to travel. So I feel like for me, one of the sacred things is having gratitude for that opportunity. So when I go somewhere, I want to try to make some kind of connection with the local culture. I want to put money into local businesses. I want to feel that connection. I'm not just like going somewhere to have some local person bring me a drink. I'm going to try to talk to some people, learn something about their experience and their culture. And
that's an interesting perspective. It means something very different to you to go away.
It really does. I want to appreciate the nature. I want to appreciate the culture. And it's also like when you go somewhere to a different country, you're an ambassador of your own country in this small way. Like I've gone some remote places. Maybe they haven't met very many Americans. Maybe they haven't met very many people who are like red-haired white people. You know, it's like I represent my country, and obviously Americans have a lot of, bad connotations around the world, especially right now. A lot of people don't like Americans. A lot of people just think Americans are all really loud and obnoxious, you know, which some are. And I'm not saying I'm never loud or obnoxious, but I take that seriously. I'm an ambassador of my country. And if I make an ass out of myself, like drinking and being rude to people, like that doesn't reflect well. And I think that there's a lot about building bridges between cultures when we travel. And it's one of the things that is our best bet for saving us from a lot of the political strife right now. Because it's if we're just like bombing someone over there that we don't know any about, it's different than it's a whole different experience when you meet someone, you talk to them, you find out all the commonalities of what you want out of life. You know, people just want the same normal things. Usually they want like happiness. They want their family to be safe. They want to have enough to eat. They want to have a laugh with their friends, like wherever you are. So I think a lot about that kind of stuff.
That's a really interesting perspective. I have to admit, I hadn't necessarily thought about it in that terms. Yes, I like to go places and I like to properly go places, you know, see the place, get under the skin of the place and, you know, take the back streets and basically really discover and meet people. But I hadn't really considered the sort of the responsibility side of that. And of course that, you know, in doing all of that, you are also, as you say, you know, supporting the business and the livelihood, which is, it's a big thing. It's a really big thing. So, okay. So I know when we talk travel and holiday that it does surface all of those things about, you know, the beliefs that we have to be drinking to have fun, the beliefs that we have to be drinking to relax, we have to be drinking to socialize. I think there's also quite a big thing about the fact that people who do go on holiday to literally lie around in the sun, I think it's something to do, which, you know, no judgment there, by the way. I love a bit of sun myself. Lying around. But I think sometimes if you're having the kind of holiday where those days stretch out like that, it is definitely something to do. It's a bit of a prop joint in those days. But you've traveled more as a non-drinker than you have as a drinker. And you've interviewed a lot of people by way of the research for your book, a lot of non-drinkers, all traveling differently, all navigating it in their own way. What emerged from them as being sort of, were some of them drinkers of old and now aren't? Were they able to draw a comparison between the sort of the drinking travel and the non-drinking travel?
Yes, some of them were.
Yeah. Yeah. So what potentially surprised them, do you think, or, you know, from the interviews that you can recall, what sort of struck you as being, I thought it would be like this and it wasn't, it was like this?
One of the people I've interviewed a few times is Darcy Murray, and she has this really cool business called, and I think now it's called Hooked Full Sensory Travel, and it's a group travel that's alcohol-free. And so she was telling me, and she's also been in the travel business as a travel agent for, I don't know, I think like 30 years or something. So she's had a lot of experience traveling with groups, both drinking and then after she quit, I forget how many years ago, not drinking. So she tells me like she felt like she really knew Italy. But then once she quit drinking, she realized she just knew Italy at night because she'd go out all these places in Rome and, you know, clubs or bars or whatever, and then sleep in. So she said she felt like she got to know it all over again when she shifted and she was doing more, you know, daytime activities, maybe wholesome or family or nature activities. So I think that's one thing. Other people tell me that they just feel a lot better because they're not hungover. They don't have a headache. And so they're able to enjoy things and feel better. Mm-hmm. People who drink to blackout, of course, they're like, oh, I remember everything that happened. That was different. And also people talk more about feelings of real connection, either with their traveling companions or the people that they meet at the destinations, because their personalities aren't all fogged over by alcohol. So those are a few things.
Yeah, well, which makes total sense, because these are the things that just do come about when you're not drinking. So of course, they're huge advantages on a holiday.
Mm-hmm.
More energy, so better sleep, more energy to get up and, you know, see the gorgeous sunrises, or go down to the market when the actual fish are being bought in, or whatever it might be. I know when I was a drinker, I'd be sort of up late and then in a bit of recovery and then sort of pretty useless until about midday. But clarity and connection. I think the time one's really interesting, isn't it? To go somewhere, spend a lot of money going somewhere and actually only probably being able to sort of max out on half of the time that you've got, because half the time is spent sleeping and getting over a big night the night before. The other thing, which I know I said when I first met you, which was a bit, well, it wasn't flippant. I absolutely meant it. I just didn't know if I had the right words or not. But for me, I look back now and I say some of my holidays when I was younger were a bit of a blur. I think it's because alcohol homogenizes everything. It sort of reduces everything to the least common denominator, which is, you know, here we are by another pool or in another bar with a drink, doing the same thing day in, day out. And it becomes almost not sort of an aside, but it almost becomes irrelevant what part of the world you might be in, because the experience is actually always the same, or at least it feels like it's always the same. So do you see what I mean when I'm talking, like, I'm not sure the right words, homogenizing or not?
No, yeah, it's like if you're traveling around and always going to, as an American, going to like Burger King or something, or McDonald's all around the world, like why do you need to go around the world to do that? Yeah, it's just the same thing in a different place.
Yeah, and I suppose, well, I mean, you tell me, you give me some of the sort of the more diverse type of holidays or travel that you've done as a non-drinker, some of the sort of ones that sort of stand in stark comparison to each other.
Yeah, so for me, the places I like to go now usually revolve around nature, so different landscapes, also culture, where there's going to be like an interesting place where I'm going to learn something about the people. But it's very interest driven. So some of the interests I've developed just in this decade in my 50s are open water swimming and scuba diving. And I've got more into kayaking too. So I really like water stuff, obviously. All these things are good for not drinking because they don't revolve around drinking. Like you can't drink and scuba dive. You can't drink and swim. You can drink a little in your kayak, but you're probably not going to drink too much. So some of these nature things have been really good for me, not directly being centered on alcohol. So I've done things like I went on a swim holiday with this fabulous UK-based trip company called Swim Trek. And we went to Croatia, and every day we just went and swam in different places in these beautiful waters. We'd swim like a few kilometers a day. So that was really cool. And I've gone places to scuba dive. And I also, of course, this isn't a good time with the war going on, but I have really enjoyed visiting the Middle East a few times, some places there. And I love the desert landscape. And I like that there's this whole hospitality industry there that doesn't focus on alcohol, since you don't really drink there unless you go to certain hotel bars. It's not the norm. So these are all some kind of different things I've experienced as a, you know, as a non-drinker.
I absolutely love that. There's some, you know, well, the kind of journeys there, the kind of travel that I'm deeply jealous about. I really sort of, you know, you have a phrase that I read, I think, and I come back to, you say you didn't get sober to have a little life. You know, you didn't get sober to live a little life. And I think what really strikes me in the kind of stories that you've just told about the kind of travel that you've done is you are building a trip around your actual interests.
I sure am.
That shouldn't sound revolutionary, should it, from a holiday perspective?
Well, some people would think it's selfish. A lot of people just, they do what their partner wants to do, or I don't have kids, so they like have to do what their kids want to do, or they do what their friends want to do. But I really like to start with what I want to do. I mean, sometimes I do what someone else wants to do too. And then sometimes I have friends that like to do the same thing. Like I swim with people here. So I went with a local swim friend, and we went to Croatia together and did this open water trip. So yeah, but it is about developing a life at home and then on your holidays where you get to do more of what you want to do and less of what you don't want to do.
Yeah, but so when you describe those kind of trips, what you're looking for from them, and then what you're getting from them is, you know, presence and connection and novelty and freedom and stimulation. You know, which turns out once you start planning with a level of intentionality of what do I actually want to do on this holiday, you know, when alcohol isn't the sort of the assumed structure, those things become much more available to you. I guess on the flip side is some of the people who would say to me, I would really struggle to go on a holiday and not drink, are talking about the kind of holidays that I spoke of before,
mm-hmm.
where maybe they have gone and flopped down by a pool for 2 weeks, you know, for the last 10, 15 holidays. And now the idea of doing exactly the same thing but without a glass in their hand is going to be really hard. And it actually would be, psychologically, it would be very, very hard because you'd be doing the same thing.
Well, I would be bored out of my mind. That sounds terrible.
But I guess for someone who like wants to do that kind of thing, they'd still be sitting there thinking, this is exactly what I've done before, but it's different only because I've got, you know, I'm not drinking anymore. And it can suddenly feel like a sort of, it can begin to feel like something that's very, very hard because of the associations, 15 years of doing that kind of thing.
Yeah, you'd also probably be thinking, God, these hours are really dragging along when I'm not drinking.
Well, exactly. Exactly. So which reinforces why alcohol is probably such a key part of those types of holidays. But I guess what you've just described is coming in from a completely different place, which is, you know, I'm not going to do the same kind of holiday that I would have done as a drinker. I'm going to do a completely different type of holiday. And actually, the world is my oyster. I mean, obviously, you've got to be able to afford these things as well, as you said earlier. But there is something incredibly liberating. Suddenly, a whole world of travel and possibilities opens up. And I think that's what's so, once you're not confined or anchored to one thing, anything becomes, you know, possible. And that's really exciting.
It is, but it's also kind of intimidating to people at first, because if you've just stopped drinking, and, you know, I was 20, so I was lucky. I was really young. I didn't have as many years of ingrained habits, even though I had a few. But the older you are and the more set in your ways you are, if drinking's taken up a really big part of your life, it's a lot harder to know what you like to do, and it's a lot scarier. So mm-hmm. you might just feel like life suddenly blank. You're like, I'm not with my friends at the pub. What on earth do mm-hmm. I do with myself?
Yep.
And so then you kind of have to get out of your comfort zone. I mean, you don't have to. You could just sit at home. But if you want to have a bigger life, you got to get out of your comfort zone and try some different things. And you may or may not like the things. And also, a lot of us, especially nowadays, where I think, again, with all the media we have available, we see all these people that are doing everything at the top of their game. So lots of times when I ask people if they like something or not, they say, no, I'm no good at that. So we also have this equating, we can only like something if we're good at it.
If we're good at it and can perform.
I try really hard in my life to figure out what I like and what I don't based on what I like and what I don't, and try not to worry so much about being the best at it. Like, I'm not the best swimmer. I'm slow. I wear fins to keep up with my swim group, you know, but I still enjoy doing it. So we have to think of it like that, and not just like, I'm really good at it, and so I like it. So we got to give ourselves permission to try different things, and then honestly think like, do I want to do this again or not? And then also try not to compare ourselves to other people as much as we generally do.
As you're talking there, it reminds me that, you know, I went through a sort of a spate of holidays in my mid-20s, late 20s, which were quite intrepid. I was single And I had decided that I was going to go to Vietnam and cycle up through Vietnam. And I didn't have anyone to go with, so I joined a group. And I flew out to Ho Chi Minh City and I joined a group who I'd never met before in a hotel and cycled up through Vietnam. I wasn't a particularly strong cyclist, but I had an attitude towards doing it. I did a similar type of holiday around Cuba. I did New Zealand in the same way with a bunch of people I'd never met before, various other places. And I guess we get to a point in life where we stop doing those things. We lose the confidence a little bit about doing those things. Some of us, not all of us, but I mean, I have to admit that if I was now going on that kind of holiday, I'd be a little bit more like, what if people don't like me? Or what if I'm not good at this? Or I guess it's just a case of it's a fantastic time, isn't it? I suppose with holidays is just to get curious. If what you're looking for is an experience, then your only limit is really your own sense of confidence and self-consciousness, maybe.
And your willingness to get outside your comfort zone. You might feel self-conscious. You might not feel that popular in the group, but you just have to sort of take it one breath at a time and just try to get through the uncomfortable parts and onto the parts that are better. Because, you know, over the course of any one day, like you're probably going to have feelings where you're feeling confident and you suddenly compare yourself to something or remember, have some memory. And, you know, there's like a lot of ups and downs. So it's the same thing if you go on a group trip with people you don't know. There's going to be moments where you feel connected and then moments where you're like, oh, I think they like that other traveler better than me. I mean, it's just like childhood or school. Like, you know, we have some of these same things in adult life. So then there might be times on a trip where I'm like, this sucks. I wish I hadn't come. But you have to wait till the end and look at sort of the balance overall and not just be married to those moments of, especially of the low points, because people tend to sort of latch onto the negative things and be like, that sucked. It wasn't worth it. And you might have a few moments where you think it sucks, but then there's probably going to be some high moments too.
Well, I'll tell you something interesting. Share something interesting. I met a couple in Ho Chi Minh City on the same trip as me on my cycling trip. And Sally, this lady said to me, oh, I have a friend called Kieran and I think he'd really get on well with you. So when we get back to London, I'll introduce you because I just have this feeling you'll get on. And we've been married for 20 years this year.
So see, if you hadn't gone cycling, huh?
it was so bizarre. I ummed and ahed. I thought, can I do this? Should I do it? Will I like it? Will I meet anyone I like? That's nothing. Will I meet anyone? Well, they don't like me. And off I went. And I went all the way to Ho Chi Minh to in a roundabout way, meet my future husband. Sally and Stephen went off and they traveled on. They went through South America and various other places before they came back to London. So it was a good 12 months before she came good on that and organized a dinner where she introduced ourselves to each other. And yeah, 20 years in a week and a half's time, we'll be married.
That is so cool. Congratulations. And how did you feel about that bike trip afterwards? Like how?
I was amazing. Well, this is the thing though, because I was about to say it's not just open. I mean, I know that doesn't happen on every holiday, but the it doesn't just sometimes do things like that, open doors and expand your horizons and stuff. It was a transformative experience for me. It was at a stage in my life when I really, really needed it. And it opened my eyes to a part of the world I'd never, ever been to. And cycling was something I fell in love with. And I realized that had I sat there waiting for the confidence, the full confidence to go, not just in myself, but also in my ability as a cyclist, I'd have never gone. I'd have never gone. And I think it's that sort of age-old adage that confidence isn't the first thing to come. You just have to do it. Mm-hmm. Do it anyway. And as I say, I know that doesn't sort of happen to everybody, but it's funny that it's only just occurred to me as I was talking to you that that was a very, very real experience I had. You know, and I'm 55 now, and I can, you know, I've said to my husband for the first time in our 20 years of marriage that I'm going on holiday on my own this year. I'm not instead of with them.
In addition to,
I just want to go away and do something new.
What are you
going to
do?
I'm going on a yoga retreat.
Nice.
Yeah. And you know what? I'm not that good at yoga. And
okay.
I just thought I want to do something and, you know, I'm going to meet a nice bunch of people doing it. and just do something which is, again, it's what do I need was the question. And then, you know, the search for the right thing came from there. And as it turns out, you know, I need a bit of, I think I'm going to need a bit of restoration come the end of September. And, you know, I just, that fit the bill. So again, I think the reason for me rambling on is it's midlife, I think, again, is another great time to sort of take assessment and potentially pivot if you're used to doing a certain thing for so long, to sort of open up travel again and open up a different type of experience. I mean, that's how I feel. Anyway, I just will speak to all the midlifers out there and just say it just feels like a good time.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And things like yoga, like when we say I'm not that good at yoga, you know, and it's the same with anything. Like I say, I'm not that good at scuba diving yet. I'm not that good at, you know, at swimming as some of the other people. But there's almost like this idea that if we get better at the yoga poses or we swim faster, something's going to happen. Like, what, are we going to get a prize? No, it's not what we can do for the yoga or the swimming, the diving. It's what they can do for us. So like the yoga, you know, you're not really there to do a pose perfectly. You're there to stretch your connective tissue, to make your muscle a little stronger, to get that feeling of the lack of stress, to get that feeling of the oneness with the universe. You know, with the diving, I'm not proving anything. I'm never good. You know, I started diving in 56. I'm never going to be some champion diver, but I'm going to get better at it, calmer. I'm going to like see some interesting sea life, you know, have those interesting experiences. So yeah, I think sometimes we need to we need to shift instead of thinking that we have to get better at something, but then thinking more, what are we getting out of it? What does this bring into our lives?
Yeah, amen to that. I mean, I'm also hoping that yoga is going to be a part of it. We're also going to sit around and eat some yummy food for a decent whack of the time as well, and just meet some nice people. But okay, I'm really conscious of the time. So let's come back to people who might be listening to this. If someone's listening, planning a holiday, quietly wondering what it would feel like to do it differently, not necessarily because they have to, not because they're in recovery, but because, you know, they're curious, what would you want them to know? What's the one thought you'd like to leave them with?
You will survive it. It won't kill you to not drink on your holiday. First of all, I don't know. We have fears sometimes. And if we examine them, like, what do we really think is going to happen? I don't know. You will be okay if you don't drink.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you do drink, you know, you don't have to shame yourself. You just rethink it. Why did I drink? Is it important to me to try again and do it differently? But I'd say if you're serious about not wanting to drink on a holiday, then there's a few things you can do that will help. One is to have the support system and share with some friends at home, first of all, your intention of not drinking and that this is your goal, because it helps to have some accountability. Because sometimes when we go on holiday somewhere, we're like, oh, I'm in a new place. Nobody knows me. I can be whoever I want. You know, so that's one reason I think people relapse sometimes, even if they've been sober for a while. So if your intention is to not drink, then have someone you're going to check in with at home, even if it's just by text, say, hey, things are going fine. You know, I'm having a good time. I'm not drinking. Or if you feel like you want to drink really badly, maybe have someone you can talk to and be like, Anna, we were talking before I left. Why did I say I didn't want to drink? And you can kind of have that conversation and be like, oh yeah, and get it back together. So the support is really good. And I also think it helps to have a bit of a plan, not like a full schedule necessarily, but know some of the things you want to do, why you're going to that place, what you want to do. Because if you're used to drinking, filling up a lot of your time, then suddenly just like a whole empty day can feel really threatening, like you don't know what to do with it. So those are just a couple of tips. Have someone you're accountable to and have a few plans that don't center on drinking.
And I guess, you know, given where our conversation finished a moment ago, definitely think about a holiday where drinking isn't going to be the main event. It's not billed as the main event, and it's unlikely to become the main event. And in fact, you know, greatly reduces the likelihood the fact that everyone else is going to be sitting around drinking. So remind us of the name of your book, because obviously that's going to be jam-packed full of other tips as well.
Oh, it's called Sober Travel Handbook.
Brilliant. Okay. Thank you so much for your time today. Most of us, I think it's fair to say, most of us who've years and years and years of drinking behind us have inherited a script for what a holiday is supposed to feel like. And I think your invite to listeners, mine too, is simply to notice it and, you know, ask what's yours. ask what you might have inherited as a script, and you know what.
Yeah, maybe do something different. Try something new.
Do something different. I think, you know, we yeah. I love the term curiosity. I think I've used it more than any other word on this podcast. It's, you know, that sense of try something new. What's the worst that could happen? You know, if you have a terrible time, you can always go back into your lane and revert to the same old, but I've never met anyone who's done that. So yeah, brilliant. Okay. I mean, as with all things alcohol related, noticing is where it all starts. So just challenge the beliefs you have around holidays and, you know, and take it from there, really. Brilliant. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time today. And do you want to leave a website address or anything like that? I can stick in the show notes anyway.
Oh, yeah. It's teresabergen.com, just my name. And also in your show notes, I think you're going to include, I sent you some links,
yes,
some group travel. There's some group travel organizers that organize alcohol-free trips. So those can be a really safe and welcoming place if you feel threatened by alcohol on your vacation and you want to go with a like-minded group of people your first time out or your 10th time out.
I was thrilled you sent those. I was expecting one or two links to come through and you sent me a whole list, for which I'm very, very grateful on behalf of listeners as well. Thank you. They will all be.
And there's more popping up all the time.
Well, I'm going to put them in the show notes, and I'm going to put them in, I've got a little resources page on my website, thebigdrinkrethink.com as well. So I'm going to stick them there. So they are super easy to find. So no one can have an excuse. Brilliant. All right, Teresa, thank you so much indeed for your time. You take care.
And thanks so much for all the work you're doing for people. I mean, you're making a difference in the world by showing more people that they can have a wonderful life without alcohol. So thanks for what you do.
Oh, thank you. All right. Well, mutual thanks. All right. Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening and getting curious. Please rate, review, and follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you're choosing to listen. It really helps other people find the show. And don't forget to tune in to the next episode. And you can find all of my resources and become part of The Big Drink Rethink by heading to my website, thebigdrinkrethink.com.